Good morning and welcome to the Europeans podcast.
Ooh, sexy morning voice.
We're recording quite early in the morning because I've got to go to rehearsal and I'm performing in the evenings. So it's a bit wild, but we're really happy to be back here to talk to our wonderful listeners once again. How are you, Katie?
I'm good. Well, I'm a bit bummed out because all the C-word stuff is getting pretty heavy again here in France. And the university where I teach in Paris has reopened for 2 weeks and is now shut again, inevitably. So we're back to doing classes on Zoom. Feels like a bit of, deja vu. But we're not here to talk about all of that stuff. I think we should reinstate our reasonably strict ban on talking about all things pandemic.
I was going to suggest the opposite because where I am in the Netherlands, it's like it's not happening, except it is.
And you think that's the fault of this podcast?
I do. I've been pretty shocked by the Dutch media over the last month as cases are rapidly rising and the fact that often the pandemic hasn't appeared in the top page of the headlines for major news outlets. So I have a feeling we might be going down the Sweden route, sadly, for this second wave, which is a little bit scary, I'll be honest. And I also think maybe we should drop our B-word ban because we're not talking enough about Brexit. I never thought I'd say that.
Certainly the rest of Europe is not talking about Brexit at all. And British friends are quite surprised when I tell them that nobody really cares or is interested in it. But I don't want to talk about the B word and the C word, Dominic. I like the fact that we talk about everything else.
Okay, we'll keep it in place at least this week. And this week we've got a very nice interview for you that has no mention of either of those things, I think. We're speaking to Simon Strauss, who is a brilliant writer and European thinker. He is seen as kind of the king of the new wave of literary romanticism in Germany. And we'll be talking to him about what it's like to hold that crown, as well as talking to him about a really interesting project he set up where he's creating an archive of voices of older Europeans that could soon be lost. But to start with...
This week's Good Week, Bad Week is a State of the Union special. We are dedicating the whole segment to Ursula von der Leyen's first State of the European Union speech as boss of the continent. Is that her job title?
Yeah, I think so.
Cool. If you're a Brussels bubble person, this was the massive event of the week. Ursula von der Leyen setting out her vision, taking stock of where we're at as a continent in this super long speech, 79 minutes, in fact. But there was a lot to unpack, and most people who listen to this podcast are not Brussels bubble people, so we're here to unpick it for you. But before we talk about the good and the bad, why do we even have this State of the Union thing?
It's only actually been around since 2010, so they're a relatively recent tradition, and it was stolen, as you might imagine, from the American tradition where the president gives their view on the state of the American Union of States and lays out their legislative agenda for the year. The European version is very similar and is there to try and create more transparency around the legislative goals and political direction of the Commission. And in its best form, it will lead to greater interest in the agenda of the Commission from the general public, even.
Okay.
Did that happen? I don't know. But Ursula did manage to spit out all 8,179 words in mainly English, but with bits of French and her mother tongue, German. And obviously, Europe and the world are currently facing an incredible assortment of crises. The B word, the health and economic crisis caused by the C word, the refugee crisis, the climate crisis. It's a lot. And I am giving Ursula good week for what was a relatively ambitious speech that felt like it was aiming for some big things that could really improve Europe and the world.
Like what?
All right, chill out. Around health, she showed that she wants to strengthen the European Health Union and she came up with various cross-border measures.
Because one of the things during coronavirus was that the EU doesn't actually have any control over health stuff, right? So that was one of the reasons that they hit back at criticism. They were like, well, there's only so much we can do on health stuff.
Yeah, and she wants to rectify that for the coming months and years and
the next
coming
pandemics.
And the one that's going to stay with us for a while. Anyway, we're not talking about C-word. She also had a joined up EU block-wide policy on minimum wages, not the same minimum wage for the whole continent, but a framework to ensure everyone in Europe is paid fairly. Sounds pretty sensible to me. Mm-hmm. On the climate, she stressed her ambition to make Europe the first climate neutral continent in 2050 and made the targets a bit more ambitious.
The European Commission is proposing to increase the 2030 targets for emission reduction to at least 55%. I recognize that this increase from 40 to 55 is too much for some and not enough for others.
Also kind of connected to the climate, I liked her idea about creating a new European Bauhaus.
Oh yeah, what was that?
She said that the climate transition needs its own distinctive aesthetic. I actually think it's quite an appealing idea and it has ambition and creativity behind it. The original Bauhaus movement had designers, architects, artists, makers who were using the new materials and methods that were available to them due to the growth of mass production to create a new aesthetic that had an everyday functionality to it. And I can see the analogy with what is needed now, that we have to produce things more sustainably. And I like this kind of creative thinking. The original Bauhaus existed because of state support. So I think if von der Leyen wants to step in and support a new cultural movement, then please do. Thank you.
That sounds very cool. I actually interviewed someone from a mini version of this that kind of exists already, some academics in Switzerland that have this really cool apartment building in Dubendorf near Zurich. They work with people from the building industry to like test out new materials, like a sort of fake apartment building where you can like test things in like scientific conditions. It's really cool.
That does sound cool.
So was that your favorite bit of her speech?
Yeah, I like that bit. But actually the bit that got to me the most was her section on discrimination and particularly what she said about homophobia in Poland.
I will not rest when it comes to building a union of equality. A union where you can be who you are and love who you want without fear and recrimination. Because being yourself is not your ideology, it is your identity. And no one can ever take it away. So I want to be crystal clear. LGBTQI-free zones are humanity-free zones, and they have no place in our union.
I thought that it was a really good bit of speech writing, and I was actually a bit moved by it. Is that embarrassing to admit?
Oh, I think that's nice.
One thing I'm definitely not ready to give her good week about yet is on migration. Let's not talk too much about that until we hear what the proposals actually are from the Commission. In fact, the proposal is being released, I think, today, the day the podcast comes out. So maybe we'll be talking about Ursula again next week. If that doesn't bring you back listening, then I don't know what will. She was also very tough on Russia, tough on China and their human rights abuses, tough on Lukashenko and supported the people of Minsk. As ever, there's only so much she can do in terms of sanction for people like Lukashenko and his lackeys without the support of all the EU member states. And one thing I think she did pretty strongly is that at various points she challenged the national leaders of EU countries to step up their game and come together to solve these multiple crises together. And she is, of course, right. Cooperation and solidarity is vital in these trying times. And there's only so much she can do unless she has both the parliament and the national leaders on board. And that brings me to why I think she had a really good week, because she did a good job at appealing to the centre ground, which might sound really pragmatic and boring. But for the sake of argument, it probably is necessary for her to continue to maintain that support if she wants to get anything done due to the makeup of the European Parliament and the majority she has there.
It's quite a lot more lefty than she is, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit more left-wing than she is. She herself is from Merkel's Christian centre-right party, but it's been argued by commentators I've been reading, people that know a lot more about the Brussels bubble and Ursula than me, that she did a really good job at pleasing the majority of the in-person audience in the European Parliament. And she managed to make herself appear more centrist and perhaps even more centre-left than her natural home in the centre-right. So I think Ursula can be pleased with herself, don't you?
Oh, no. I quite regret taking on Bad Week now. I feel like I'm going to be a bit of a negative Nancy. But the format does require me to pile on loads of criticism, essentially. So what I'm about to say is caveated by the fact that I do actually agree with you. I think there was a lot of good stuff in the speech. However, with my bad hat on, I would say that one area where Ursula could have been a lot more forceful is when it comes to calling out European governments that are chipping away at democracy in a really disturbing fashion. Looking at you, Hungary and Poland, As you said, Dominic, she did call out Poland on these horrible LGBTQ free zones, and that was really heartening to see. But when it came to one of the elephants in the European room at the moment, which is the really disturbing state of democracy in Hungary and Poland, the approach was kind of softly does it. Here's what she had to say.
Before the end of the month, the Commission will adopt the first annual rule of law report covering all member states. It is a preventive tool for early detection of challenges and for finding solutions. I want this to be a starting point for Commission, Parliament and member states to ensure there is no backsliding.
So when you listen to that clip and you hear her talking about, like, let's ensure that there's no backsliding, it just kind of sets alarm bells ringing. Like, there is already massive democratic backsliding. How much more can there be, you know? I mean, some rankings of how democratic countries are already list Hungary as a non-democratic or authoritarian country. Like, most of the media in that country is essentially propaganda. The independent court system in Poland is being dismantled. As the politics professor R. Daniel Kellerman put it this week, the house is already on fire.
Didn't she have some clever idea to make the coronavirus rescue fund money dependent on countries, like, proving that they were actually democratic?
Yeah, and quite a lot of countries in Europe would still like that to be the case. But surprise, surprise, the coronavirus rescue package is currently being held up because Poland and Hungary are threatening to block the entire budget and rescue package if the funding is made conditional on them being good democracies. So we're kind of stuck.
Did you hear what the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte said in Parliament a few weeks ago relating to Hungary and Poland and the EU?
I didn't. What did he say?
It was kind of like a little rhetorical flourish, so you maybe shouldn't take it too seriously. But he asked, can you make a budget via an intergovernmental agreement? Or can you found an EU without Hungary or Poland? Mm. And people have like been jumping on this recently, being like, oh, is he suggesting we should set up the new European Union without Hungary and Poland? Is that the only way to deal with it?
It's just like a band reforming just to get rid of like a member that they don't like.
I think it's just like that, except it would have even more complicated consequences. So, yeah, I'm not sure it's the right way ahead, but I also don't know what is. If anyone has any brilliant ideas, then maybe they should write in and we can solve it together, yeah?
Yeah, that sounds good. I don't think anyone has any answers on this front. And to be honest, it's not a massive surprise that von der Leyen was quite mild in what she had to say about Hungary and Poland and democracy in general, because she signaled from the beginning that she didn't think it was helpful to be too confrontational about it. And I do get that from a pragmatic point of view, but it still makes me furious that there don't seem to be any real negative consequences for countries that are just, yeah, chipping away at democracy in this way. And then taking loads of money from the EU.
Yeah, it's pretty grim. You know, something I'm really interested in, which we didn't really discuss, is did any of the general public actually notice this was happening? Because that would be a good barometer of whether this was actually a good week for her. Because I get the impression that maybe people didn't. Although her thing about LGBT-free zones in Poland did seem to climb the headlines on some of the liberal news outlets I look at.
That did a little bit. I'd certainly hear in France, the speech was not anywhere near the headlines. And I don't think any of my friends here have followed it. Listeners outside the Brussels bubble, let us know if this kind of cut through the noise or not. Do you know what? Despite all of the crap that has been happening around the world of late, there was one bright spot in my week this week, and that was all the emails that landed in our inbox announcing that this podcast has new supporters. There were loads of them.
Thank you, lovely people. This week's new supporters include Eric Lut, Olga Volak, Claire Chambers, Adrian Murphy, longtime friend of the show, and Federico Gobbo, who is also a longtime friend of the show, and our second new Patreon in 2 weeks that is a previous guest of the show.
Do you think all of our previous guests are being shamed into giving us money now?
Yeah.
Which doesn't make any sense because they've already given loads of their time up to talk to us. So nice.
It's really nice, but who's it going to be next week? Katie, maybe we should direct people to our episode with Federico. He is one of the world's leading Esperanto experts.
Yeah, and we talked to him back in August last year about how the internet has shaken up this wonderful invented language. So check it out. The episode was called Hip Hoppo, which I think is Esperanto for hip hop, and I can't remember why we called it that. Would you say that you look at Europe in a romantic way, Dominic?
Right now, no. I look at it in a really uninspired, practical way. But the fact that we created this podcast is a bit romantic.
I think so. Like, I sometimes get a bit misty-eyed about it and how it's brought people across the continent together and further afield as well. But then I'll, like, read a really boring EU press release about fishing regulation and think, maybe not. But one person who has been arguing that we should look at Europe in a more romantic way is the German writer and historian Simon Strauss. He is, as Dominic said, part of this wave of German thinkers and writers who are making a case for a return of romanticism, by which I mean, and I'm going to massively dumb this down now, so I apologise to philosophically minded listeners out there, but basically when we talk about romanticism, we're talking about this 19th century intellectual movement that emphasised like human emotion, and it played a really important role in shaping how we feel about liberty in Europe, because it put a lot of emphasis on the individual. So when you apply that to Europe, what Simon is basically arguing is that Europe needs to be about more than rational, boring things like tax legislation. Like, it needs to capture the imagination, which is difficult to argue with. Along with thinking about Europe, Simon is one of those disgustingly successful people who seem to have done way too much despite being, I think, about the same age as you and me, Dominic. He is a theatre critic. He is a historian. He is the author of a smash hit novel called Seven Nights, which took the German literary world by storm. And he is one of the people spearheading a really nice project, getting young and old Europeans to talk to each other, which is one of the things that we talked about in the really excellent chat that we had.
Your writing is often described by critics as being part of this German revival of romanticism. Is there a way we could inject some romanticism into the way we talk about Europe as a continent? Or is romanticism a dangerous tool to use politically in this sense?
No, I don't think so. First and foremost, romanticism in itself is a European force. As a literary tradition, it wasn't a national-based movement, but it was always pan-European. So it's maybe one of the earliest movements, I would say, from the European spirit. And then secondly, I would say that, yes, indeed, we need and we can use parts of the romantic tradition even today in our political talk. So the common criticism, obviously, is always this coldness, this bureaucratic distance feeling we have when we talk about Europe today. And so romanticism there could help to have a look beyond and behind this only purely bureaucratic system.
Do you think there are any politicians out there that are doing that well at the moment?
Well, I tend to, and that's not very like not something special that I say, but I tend to look towards the French president, Macron, in a kind of admirable way, because I think what we can learn or what we can understand when we listen to him is that the power of speech and the power of rhetoric, a felt language, a language you can feel, is also an option, I would say, to talk about our present times and maybe to even reach out to people who are often, stressed out and a little bit disappointed by politics.
What can the EU itself be doing on that front? Because it does, as you say, often feel very distant and bureaucratic and boring and, well, not very inspiring.
Exactly. When we look at how laws are being made and how the discussions in the parliament in Brussels are being held, they're always around the economy or political sphere. But we very, very rarely see discussions about cultural questions, you know, and the power of culture. From time to time, I think that politicians look into culture as, you know, the nice concert in the evening. But that's not culture. Culture is on the fundament of the European idea. And I think this is really, really a key moment where we should understand that the cultural dimension of Europe, which means asking the bigger questions, asking existential questions, talking about the human beings in Europe, not only as economic persons, but also as cultural beings, that is what is culture about, and not just the classical concert or the pop concert in the evening.
Do you mean that we should be kind of also searching for the things that create a common, a shared European culture between us to work out what it is that makes us European? Or is that kind of trying to make a monoculture? Should we be celebrating the diverse cultures of Europe as well?
there will always be different approaches towards, for example, religion, family. There will be always differences. But I think the fundamental value of the European consciousness is to accept these differences as a value in itself. You know, we are strong enough to debate these differences, whereas in other parts of the world, you know, where you have dictatorships or hidden dictatorships, you don't have these kind of open debates and the open acceptance of differences. This is really what is European. And you can see, I would always say, it's so nice to look at our architecture, you know, the piazza, the place, you know, this is a real European thing. And what was it about? It was not just for the markets. Obviously, that was one of the main reasons for these open spaces in our cities, in European cities, but it was also there for open debate. And you only have debate if you have differences. So in the end, the piazza is really the fundamental icon of European consciousness.
There was quite a lot of debate around your first novel, Seven Nights, which received a lot of very positive attention, and it was a hit. But it also had some intellectual pushback in the press from some voices who suggested that this neo-romanticism was serving the agenda of the right. Mm-hmm. Things got pretty heated by the sounds of things. What was it like for you and your work to suddenly be in the middle of this intellectual confrontation?
I mean, looking back, it was exciting. At the time, it was a little bit frightening because obviously, as you said, you write a book and you write a personal book, and it all came into this post-2015 sphere of migration questions and the rise, obviously, of the radical right in German politics. So mm-hmm. It was a very distinct moment where this discussion or debate arose. Today, I would say that a discussion about how romantic politics should be or not wouldn't happen the same way as 4 or 5 years ago, because if you look, for example, at the climate movement, you know, Greta's movement, Fridays for Future, they obviously have a romantic idea, and it's not a purely modernist, progressive idea what they have. They have a very critical approach towards modernity. So in some sense, the climate movement helped to widen the horizon in this whole debate.
Another project that you're involved in, Dimon, is the European Archive of Voices. Can you tell us a little bit about it? What is it exactly?
Yeah, I mean, to try to connect these two things, maybe the romantic question and the archive. When I wrote my second book, I wrote it in Rome. I didn't actually plan to write a book, but I just wanted to go away from Germany and all of these discussions. And when I was in Rome and studying basically history every day when I walked through the city, I came across the idea that, you know, what is Rome? Rome shows us vulnerability, and Rome shows us obviously destruction of history, you know, how big Rome was in the early times and what is it now. But then it also shows us that there's still remains of the past, you know. And then this idea of an archive came up. The simple underlying idea was, okay, right now, 2019 it was, there are still so many interesting people living who have historical knowledge, not just facts, but you can feel history through these people throughout Europe. So what we talked about in the beginning, how can we make Europe more romantic in some sense? How can we make it more touchable? I had the idea to get a network of these old generation, which is about obviously to die, and we can for once more involve them into long discussions about their lives and how they look onto the European idea.
So the idea was to have all of these intergenerational conversations between young people and old people all over Europe. This hasn't been the easiest time to have intergenerational conversations because of older, sort of more vulnerable people having to keep at a distance from germy younger people like us. Has this project come to a halt during the pandemic, or have you been able to go ahead with it?
We luckily had most of the interviews. So by now we have more than 50 interviews, and we had like around 40 by March this year, so when the corona started. So the last 10 interviews we did over Skype, I think, and telephone. But we had discussions about in our group, because we're now a group of 20 people who are engaged in this project, in this European Archive project. And we have discussions about the value of it. What does it mean? What do we do it for? You know, my a little bit intellectual aim in the beginning was really to leave something behind. So I always look at this project as, you know, in 100 or 150 years, people will have a possibility to look into the past through our archive. And so my main idea was to leave something behind for future generations. But now in the Corona times, obviously we always talked about the value also of this generation, this, as you say, very vulnerable generation, and how important it is to give them a voice as well, especially now.
Something else I really like about it is that it brings young and old people together at a time when there's been, you know, quite a lot of intergenerational conflict across Europe, right? In terms of not even just old people accusing young people of spreading coronavirus by
partying,
being irresponsible in their socializing, and but more broadly, young people accusing old people of like generally stealing their futures and ruining the housing market and things like this. Do you think getting people to sit down from different generations is one way of fixing that?
Oh, definitely. I think it's, and also it coming back to the, you know, core European consciousness of accepting differences in dialectics. It's so interesting when you listen to these interviews of young and very old people talking about common issues, a young and an old feminist, you know, a young journalist in Austria discussing feminism with an old woman who was in the beginnings of feminism, and they don't agree at all about what it is to fight for rights and all of these things, you know. So it's very, very at the core of the present debates. And as you say, the intergenerational debate is so important, because from time to time we tend to think that politics is only about this middle age group. No, I mean, we have this strange feeling of politics is made in the middle. It's very important to have these intergenerational between the young and the old.
Thank you to the Forum on European Culture for setting up this interview. This is part of a series of interviews we've been doing with people who have been part of the Forum of European Culture this year. Francesca Melandri was the first one 2 weeks ago, and our final one happens next week with Eniola Aluko, the British Nigerian football star. The Forum actually took place last weekend in Amsterdam, and it was amazing. I was there, as was our producer Katz. They had some really fascinating people speaking and debating, and most of their events are available to watch online for free still now, I think. So go check them out at cultureforum.eu. Simon was there as well, but only at a closed event. So if you're interested in hearing more from him, then I recommend you get his book, Seven Nights, or check out his really hopeful keynote speech from 2018 at the Forum on European Culture, where he talks about possibilities for Europe. We'll post a link in the show notes.
And the link to the European Archive of Voices as well, so you can check that out as well.
Lots of extra listening and reading for you all.
All of the links.
And maybe even more now, because we're moving on to Isolation Inspiration. This podcast is just becoming a list of links, Katie.
The people love links. What have you got to recommend for us this week?
I'm sticking with romanticism. Ooh. I listened to a really nice podcast about Tchaikovsky, the Russian romantic composer. It's a podcast called Decomposed, presented by the American pianist and storyteller Jade Simmons.
Oh yeah, you quite like that one, don't you?
Well, it's very American, which is not a problem, but it really does have a different tone, I think, to if it had been presented by a European. Am I digging myself into a hole?
Maybe. Let's see how much hate mail we get this week.
But this episode is called Why Did You Betray Me? And Jade Simmons is really good at telling this fascinating story of two women in Tchaikovsky's life who he had relationships with over letters. So if that sounds intriguing, then go and give it a listen. It's also just got some incredible music as the soundtrack by Tchaikovsky, of course.
Lovely.
What about you, Katie?
I've got another French film recommendation for you this week. I rewatched La Haine because I was recently reminded that the film is 25 years old this year. If you don't know it, La Haine, or Hatred, is a massively influential French film about three kids from immigrant families living in the Paris suburbs during a time of riots. One of their friends is in hospital after being very badly beaten up by the police. The film is beautifully shot in black and white. It came out in 1995, and it is still, I was going to say it's still as depressing as ever, but that's not quite what I mean. I think the thing that really hits you is that the big themes of this film haven't gone away. Like, police violence has not gone away. The inequality of the city that I live in has not gone away. And I really thought it was worth a rewatch. It's actually showing in UK cinemas at the moment because of the anniversary. And it is similarly available on a wide variety of internet streaming services.
For people that aren't brave enough to go to a cinema.
Exactly.
Me.
Funnily enough, it was also the first film I ever watched in French without subtitles. And it's really slangy. So rewatching it, I don't know how much I understood the first time, but it must have been about 20% or something. So it was definitely also worth rewatching for me because it was a nice reminder that I can actually speak French now.
That's pretty cool. Proud of you, Katie Lee.
Merci.
This happy ending fits into that occasionally appearing category of death happy endings.
You've had a series of quite gothic happy endings this season.
Yeah, I'm into it. We all have to have this final ending of our life sometime. And if we're going to go, why not make it a happy one and even an ending that could be giving back to the natural environment?
Okay.
A new coffin has been designed by the Dutch innovator and biodesigner Bob Hendricks, along with a group of students at the Technical University in Delft. And this coffin is made out of fungus.
Ooh.
The simple idea is to bury your body in a way that will give back the nutrients from your body to the earth. This might sound like a bit wishy-washy, but the team are dead serious about this project. They ask, are you waste or are you compost? They believe we can be compost with the help of this mycelium coffin. Do you know what mycelium is?
I do not know what mycelium is.
It's a vegetative part of a fungus consisting of a network of fine white filaments.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of this stuff.
Yeah, it's quite magical, actually. And Bob Hendricks, the designer, describes it as nature's largest recycler. It's a living organism that is searching for dead things, which it can convert into useful things for the environment. And it was used, for example, in Chernobyl to help clean up the soil. So they think it will take about 30 to 45 days for the coffin to be taken up into the ground. And whilst a human body usually takes about 10 years to decompose, with the help of the mycelium, they think it will only take around 2 to 3 years. Anyway, the first burial took place this month in the Netherlands, and the team will be looking closely to see if their theory works and if our human bodies can help clean up some polluted areas and give something back to the soil.
What would you want growing on top of you?
I think maybe this spider plant that I have in my house, because it's like taking over my apartment. So it feels fitting that it would also take over my grave.
Oh.
It's one of those plants that keeps having babies, but my husband can't bear to let any of the babies die. So we currently have 28 cuttings. We've started planting them in little jars of soil and leaving them in these like free bookshops that are around Amsterdam where you're meant to leave books to share, but we leave our plants. If anyone has any clever ideas what to do with our poor little baby plants, then let us know.
You could break into people's houses and leave them loads of plants.
It's probably the best idea. Thank you for being with us this week whilst my voice warms up in preparation for my rehearsal. I hope you have a good day, Katie. You've got to teach, haven't you, but online.
Yes, indeed. But we will be back next week to talk about football, actually. A first for this podcast, I'm pretty sure. You might have noticed we're not aesthetically minded around here. However, we have a brilliant interview lined up with Enya Luko, former star of the England women's football team. And we're going to be talking about racism in football, among other things. Don't miss it. In the meantime, you can come and hang out with us on the social media websites. We are on Twitter, at EuropeansPod. If you would like to see a picture of me as a baby, stuffing cake into my face, check out our Instagram, at EuropeansPodcast. And we're on Facebook too. Just type in the Europeans Podcast.
See you next week, everyone.
Cheers.